You Can Hack It, Episode 11, Antagonists and Gaming as a Couple.
1, 2, 3, Android, are you ready? Come on.
You are listening to You Can Hack It. I'm John.
And I'm Kyle. Join us for the next hour,
or so,
as we delight your senses.
No matter the game,
no matter the challenge,
you can hack it. Warning, You Can Hack It has a lot of profanity. You have been warned. Put your pants off, girl, you got legs like shotguns. Welcome back. Kyle, it's been like 24 hours, and it feels like 48. In that I missed you so much.
My butt cheeks have been cold without you.
I know. Nestled in there. your pierogi needs my potato. And cheese.
My sausage needs your bun? Or is it the other way around?
I'm not sure. It depends. We're versatile.
So what do you like in your sausage, John? Do you like...
A little bit of sauerkraut?
I was going to ask about the sauerkraut, because sauerkraut always adds a bit, you know?
Mustard. Welcome, everyone. We are recording a day later from our previous podcast, because we're amazing and we're hardcore, and we're going to be giving this 110%. I am excited because today we're going to be talking about my favorite people in movies, and that's antagonists. I'm excited. It's going to be great. Do you know that I was an antagonist?
Like, professionally?
No, I played one once, you know, in sort of a summer stock sort of deal. I had a ray gun.
Oh, yes. Yes, okay.
You don't remember that at all? I thought you were the priest. Were you the priest of the
Yes,
film?
I was.
And I trapped you and... did you black all that out? Like, was I that horrible that I?
To me, that was. I guess I so that it was role playing, of course, but I wasn't thinking as a role playing game. My mind was going to all the role playing games I've been involved with you, and that to me wasn't the same path. Those circuits, those brain lengths, waves are connected, or a different part of the brain. They're connected to wedding, to a bunch of different people as well, and to, like, doing something
equals
awesome.
Wedding, and it wasn't,
It was equals wedding and equals role-playing, so
That's interesting. But I was a bad guy there. I was an antagonist.
It's true.
But I had reason to be that I was an antagonist. There was a whole backstory. And in the end, I was redeemed. Which is a great arc for the villain. Speaking of which, villains, I dispatched a villain in the game that I ran last night, the D&D game. And then he came back as a lich, and they killed him again. It's a tough fight.
Which is good, because they like rolling dice, maybe.
They do like rolling their dice, they do like fighting the guys, and they killed him twice, which made them pretty happy, and now they don't know how to destroy his phylactery, so they basically have this, like, ticking time bomb for him to return. So they're like, what do we do? We can't do 40 points of damage in a single shot. So they're looking for, like, a mountain or something to throw it off of. So that was last night, that's the only role gaming I've done. There was supposed to be some gaming tonight, didn't end up happening. One of our players is AWOL, which is sad.
Yeah, I have a feeling there was... Not as a miscommunication as much as I didn't remind him, and maybe I should have. That's not really my fault, per se, though I should have probably reminded him, but it's, you know, he should have remembered at the same time.
But it gave us an opportunity to speak to the masses.
There's like 40-some people who are subscribed regularly.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then all you people, hello.
Imagine, we could be walking along the street, John, and we could be seeing some of them face-to-face and not know they're our listeners.
While they're listening to our podcast, watching us walking by.
And they wouldn't even know we were the people they're listening to. It would be even worse if they were listening to it in bed.
I listen to a lot of podcasters in bed. I gotta tell you, man, Sons of Cryos, they sung me to sleep every night. Paul Tevis, his dulcet tones. When I was in Africa, he was what kept me sane.
Yeah, I think he stepped away from Voice of the Revolution as well. Or he stepped in, I can't remember.
He's done podcasting. His voice will be heard no more. A great silence falls over the podcasting gaming community as Paul Tevis walks into Valinor and White Shores in the west.
Southeast.
No, it's the west. Isn't it the west? I thought it was always west.
I think it's... I'm just fucking with you.
Like, we need some sort of Lord of the Rings authority.
I do have a guide to the Middle Earth somewhere around here.
You also have Lord of the Rings, the National Lampoon's 1950s or 60s making fun of the Lord of the Rings trilogies, which is...
Somebody gave it to me for a birthday. I don't remember who. I think I like him.
Yes, he's a handsome fellow.
He's a handsome fellow. I think I even do a podcast. Hey, wait a second, it was you!
It's me all along! I revealed myself, I pulled back my face, and I reveal John without a face.
Well, that isn't your real face, John? I always thought that carrot nose is part of your face. I thought it was just a deformity.
I was a very happy soul. Cork cob pipe. A button nose.
But you just took it off. This is the first time I've seen John.
Wait a minute. Frosty had a button nose, not a carrot nose. That's kind of messed up. It's like every snowman ever made is a lie. We should end this. What are we doing? Anyways, antagonists, it'll be great. Do you have anything else to talk about?
I just want to say that I love my wife. I don't think I've said that enough in the podcast. Okay, she started listening to them now, so I want to make sure I get the plug in there.
Oh my god.
Let's get on to the hack then.
Fit all the gaming podcasts you possibly can inside your head with RPGpodcasts.com.
I am Galdor, Lord of Might, and you will die because you're a hero and I say so.
Okay, that was awful. Let's try this one more time. Let's go with something that I would actually care about. Galdor, Lord of Might? Let's go with something better. Come on, you can do better. Come on.
I'm Galdor, your long-lost friend, and you thought you killed me. But I did not die, but I blame you for my death, and I will get my vengeance on you.
Nice. Real nice. Now that's an antagonist I'd give a shit about. So today we're going to be talking about antagonists. We're going to be talking about what makes a good one and what makes a really poor one. Who is your favorite antagonist in literature and in a game that you've played? Let's start with literature. Literature includes movies for some reason, because I'm an undisciplined barbarian.
I actually don't know. Off the top of my head, I can't pull out a great antagonist who I've read recently. How about you, Johnny Star?
Darth Vader is my favorite antagonist from movies. Like, not the new reimagined Darth Vader of, "No, I'm terrible." No, the original Darth Vader was an incredible villain. He had all kinds of development all the way through the movies. If you watch all three movies, the movies that matter, he's a great character. He's really evil, and you kind of get it. You kind of, the reveal and everything else, he's just a deadly, horrible force. He's got a purpose. He wants to bring order to the galaxy, and you're in his way, and he can force choke your ass into the ground. For literature, I'd have to probably go with Saruman, because he represents a good guy gone bad. And that's one of my favorite arcs, the fall and possible redemption. Like, there was a chance he could have been redeemed, but he chose darkness. And that was always something that I liked about him. I thought Sauron was not very interesting. Saruman really was.
Yeah, Sauron, he was just a unknown evil that you could pin everything on. And he really wasn't. And you notice the way he was used, he wasn't used as a antagonist for where people have dialogue with. He was just this unknown evil that would show up and people could be frightened of. Which is good enough, but you really need Saruman to be somebody you can actually talk to and really kind of fight against to make it really interesting. I think that's...
And the idea that this was a really good guy that got taken down, and that actually put all of the Fellowship at risk. It indicated that this evil is so seductive, it took one of the best wizards in the world and turned him evil. That's bad news. Like, and it showed the corruptive influence a lot. I think it really made a difference.
There is a lot of interesting, I would say, Battlestar Galactica, the new series. There are a number of Cylons that made excellent antagonists, especially because they were friends before and some of them actually had memories. And
how you talk about, like, Boomer, for example.
Boomer is a perfect example of that. How, when she, especially when she regained her memories, she chose to stay with the Cylons, but she had all these memories of being a human as well.
Right.
But her choices were of who she chose to stick with. And
Whereas you take someone like Six, started full knowledge of who she was, and eventually did the other thing. She went the other direction. Like the idea that Boomer's going from ignorance to knowledge to joining with the dark side, or the bad guys, and then Six's knowledge of fully being aware of what she did, atoning, moving over to the other side. It was kind of an interesting perpendicular arc. Juxtaposition, says the beautiful woman in the wings. I can't say it nearly as sexually as that. Could you say it again?
Juxtaposition.
Oh my god!
I might have a discussion with you, John, later.
Beings! What did happen?
Didn't Boomer come back at the end? I forget.
Did you watch the last episode? I don't want to ruin it.
Yeah. I don't remember.
She kind of does towards the end. Yeah. Spoilers. She dies. Someone shoots. I think other Sharon shoots her in the head. Thanks for my kid. Boom. You shouldn't have stole my kid in the first place. You horrible monster.
Tad Williams' memory sorrow and thorn.
The dragon bone chair. This is cool.
Yeah, obviously well-loved paperback that feels like leather.
Yeah.
And in it, there's King Elias, who goes off the complete fucking deep end.
Oh, the insane villain? That's a good one.
But he's also influenced by this kind of nebulous other, almost like Sauron, but at the end the nebulous other becomes revealed, and his story is a huge tragedy, just like King Elias's. It's this really interesting way of almost mirroring the two of them, but also having this real, like, creepy as shit, insidious evil that kind of permeates the story.
Right on. Right on. This is, I've never heard of this. Chad Williams.
He is my Tolkien. I read this series almost at least once a year.
You need to tell everyone your name.
I'm Katie. I'm Kyle's wife.
Hi. There we go. I'm super glad because I suddenly realized that we haven't identified who you are, giving us all this awesome stuff. Chad Williams. Read his books. I'm going to put a little link up maybe to an Amazon link for it. That'd be great. I'm thinking about this. Another great villain I was thinking of that really gets developed over time. Doesn't get developed well until later on, but if you ever read the book Wicked, I really like the Wicked Witch of the West after reading Wicked.
I would really like to, especially because the play has been having mad success.
She's amazing, and she's antagonist, but there is something to that.
And sometimes antagonist isn't necessarily clear. Like, one of my favorite, it's hard to say if she's an antagonist or heroine, is Medea in Euripides' play, where kills her kids. She flies off in a chariot to the gods, into the stars to the gods, in the end of the play.
That's a hell of an ending.
Yeah, and her husband is really, I guess, the true antagonist in some ways, who tells her that, you know, you don't be so crazy, go just move away, it'll be fine, I want to marry this other princess, I don't want you anymore, but the kids will be fine, just be cool, it'll be fine, you'll be good here. I'll marry this beautiful princess, become a king, that's all I ever wanted, right? Our kids will be well kept care of. And Medea's like, no, fuck you.
Medusa's a good example of that, too. You know what? If you think of her, we're going through Greek myth, Medusa's a great antagonist because she's been wronged, and she's still a villain, but she's only a villain because, is it Perseus that cuts off her head?
Perseus, yes.
Yeah, because Perseus is kind of a douche. Medusa's only crime was to be more beautiful than Hera. That was it. And Hera's like, I'm a bitch, so don't you dare drink my milkshake. It's time for the comeuppance. And then she clawed her eyes out.
Compared with the Reavers.
Oh, yeah, from Firefly. That's a good example.
Well, it's not just the Reavers, it's...
Well, it's the whole... It's the corporation. And the government and government. All the rest of it. Like, I mean, a whole government entity being this antagonist. You find out why, and I mean...
There is, in the TV anime, Cowboy Bebop, Spike, his longest friend, damn if I remember what his name is now. It's a friend from a long time ago. They're different sides of the fence now. And they're now enemies. And they have to fight each other. And he knows he must fight. He doesn't want to, but he has to. Because that's what, morally, this is what his stance is. And he must fight against what his other friend represents now. And he cannot let himself do anything other than that. And I think that makes a great antagonist when they just happen to be the wrong side of the fence.
Yeah, and that's really makes it memorable. I mean, in-game enemies that I've really enjoyed. I don't know why, but I always liked Ethko from our game with Scott, the D&D game. Ethko was hilarious because he was, for one, it was a very memorable villain because it was this big lump of plasticine that he had Scott had made into this. Kind of fell apart accidentally. The Play-Doh dried out. He fell apart. But it was kind of funny because the idea was Ethko was this big, like, weird, mossy titan giant thing. And as we were beating on him, he just said, this piece rips off, and this piece rips off. And it was kind of fun. But also, Ethko was just this neat villain that had taken over these giants, and we had fought him. And it was kind of, always sticks out in my mind that I always remember Ethko. But I think I remember him more because he was a very simple villain. He had very simple aims. He wanted to be king. He wanted to rule his land, but he was ruling it as a despot.
You just hit on one of the points. And the antagonist has a clear and simple objective and goal that people can understand, can go, look, that's his goal. He wants to be king. And we go, well, we don't want him to be king. And you can oppose him very easily. And it makes a great antagonist when you both have opposing view of
the basic archetype is actually really useful. When you break things down, because you want to start simple when you're creating any kind of antagonist, the adjective noun is a good place to start. And again, that creates the archetype. So if you go with vengeful lover, would-be king, desperate killer, ruthless despot, those sort of things are a great starting point. But I think you need to flesh it out from there. You need to give the antagonist some sort of reason that he's doing what he's doing. And you have to really keep those goals clear. And most importantly, they have to challenge, they have to imperil, and they have to go against what the players want.
That's exactly it. If antagonists have the same goals as the players, then...
They're not antagonists. They're buddies.
And that's okay. You can have some of those in a game. That should be fine. But if you're going to have a person be the antagonist, they have to be opposed, and the players have to want to oppose him.
Every rogue in a D&D game needs a cop or a authority chasing after them. And every warrior needs a wizard that's trying to machinate against him. I mean, the Conan, what was his name? Set or Sutet? What was the name of James Earl Jones' character?
Oh, yes.
I cannot believe I can't remember his name. I watched that movie like a million times. But that disparate difference between that, again, you're looking at a dark mirror, in a sense. You're trying to create this antagonist that's supposed to be against it, but it's supposed to represent different values and has goals counter to what the players want. Because the players need to really hate him, despise him. They really need to get their hooks into it and want that guy defeated, dethroned, killed, usurped, or made or belittled in some way. Again, antagonists can occupy a number of different roles. You don't have to just kill them all.
Sometimes antagonists, we're talking about like simple objectives, simple like goals they want. Sometimes it is more complicated. So you may have points in games where it takes a bit to build antagonists up to that really hated point. But some of that can create really interesting role-playing to get to that point.
Exactly. And I mean, one of the nice things is having a friendly NPC turn into an enemy NPC over the course of time through choices the players make. I had that happen a couple of times in some of my games where a player would decide not to save this one person, make decisions that imperil the lives of another. And I had that come back to bite them where they're like, yeah, that's my fault. I did that. And when that happens, it creates a sense of sympathy that I think is nice. It's not necessary, but it's really nice to have if the players can identify even a little bit with the antagonist in question. If they can identify with that antagonist, then they empathize with it a little bit, and it makes the character a little more human.
Or, as you're saying, if they're responsible for the antagonist, is the way he is taking this route, if they're responsible, they're guilty then of the antagonist becoming that person he is. For them to oppose him now is now trying to rectify a mistake maybe, but if they hadn't made the mistake to begin with, they would be in this position. So it really makes them think, the players, it makes them go, well, all right, can I actually go through this? Can I do this? It really leads to really good role-playing, and that's at least a fun.
Yeah, and I think that's big. I mean, you really want the cathartic moment of besting the villain, but maybe you're besting him by redeeming him. And there's a lot of different ways that can go. I'm a big fan of seeing where that sort of heads into. I like to sort of play with that a little bit. In terms of personality, I really like to use a couple of ideas that different people have had in the past. Using the three traits is a really good way of starting with a character and then building up from there. Like saying the character is loud, aggressive, and walks with a limp. And you use those three descriptives to start that. And then you build off from there. Why is he loud? Why is he aggressive? Why does he walk with a limp? Well, maybe he's loud and aggressive because he was a sergeant. Maybe he walks with a limp because he was shot, so now he has to teach. Now you have the angry drill sergeant who your character hates.
Hot War is a great example. We're playing it recently. Each NPC is given three traits. Two positive, one negative. And that just fleshes out the character right there. It helps you a whole lot. And when I'm looking at these characters, I'm at the GM, I go, oh, this person is seductive, loves violence, and is a shopaholic.
And you ask yourself, what do these mean, and where do they come from, and what does that do to the character in question? I mean, building an antagonist, a really good one, is just like building a protagonist, a player character. You're putting the same amount of attention onto it because you want that antagonist to be memorable. And it depends on the game. I mean, really. I mean, with D&D, you also want to do abilities and stats. And I think that comes into play. But I think on a basic level, you need the characters to identify with them as a person rather than a collection of stats. I think that when you are playing an antagonist, you very much should get into it. Play that character to the bone. I think as a GM, this is your chance to shine, to get up there, to put as much characterization into the antagonist as possible. Especially if it's a major antagonist, if it's a major lieutenant or even the big bad guy himself, depending on how you're structuring it. But this is where you really gotta play it up. The more you play it up, the more players will appreciate it.
Referencing Hot War, because it's right in there, it says play the NPCs hard, play them to the bone, push them. Like, they have their objectives, they want to get them. The players should feel pushed, and they should feel like they are opposing something else.
Exactly. So we've talked about what makes a good antagonist. Do you think, should we move on to what makes a bad antagonist? What are some perils we should fall into?
Absolutely.
And I think we should start with, we've talked about archetypes, which are basic outlines that you build from. The opposite of the end of an archetype is a stereotype. A stereotype is where you are creating essentially a character that's a dead end. A good example of a dead end character is a ninja assassin. Now, if you don't say anything else about that, that's a stereotype. If you say a ninja assassin trying to find a cure for his sister,
there's an extra element there.
You know, again, I think the biggest thing with stereotype is you stop at the first two words, and that's it. The archetype is designed for building. A stereotype is where you stop there and say, ninja assassin, what else do you need to know? You need more. You need more information. You need to flesh that out.
The loudmouth coward. All right, fantastic. But if that's all he is, like, why is he a coward? Why is he a loudmouth? If he's saying, a loudmouth coward who's trying to prove himself to his friends that he can do it.
Loudmouth coward, abused by his father, looking for someone to be friends with but doesn't know how. Again, that creates a character that has more depth than someone who's just loudmouthed and a coward. Again, you want to add more to it. Again, that's the big difference between a stereotype. A stereotype doesn't expand on the basic archetype.
Don't use a stereotype, make it an archetype. You need to flesh it out, and then you need to have goals, you need to have personality, and push those archetypes hard.
I understand that in certain games, you can say, okay, five orcs attack. That's a little boring. But what if Grumbash and his warband of five finger severers come in, and each of them have a finger for every human and demi-human they've killed, and they wear them as a necklace. Suddenly you have characters like, what have you done? Look at these fingers he's got. Look at these people he's killed. We got to get them. By adding a little bit of characterization, at least a little bit, it makes it more interesting. Five orcs, I mean, come on. They're just numbers on a page. Nobody gives a damn. But if you start adding a little bit of characterization, if you make the other orcs terrified of Grumbash, and Grumbash talks to himself or something, make him a little crazy, then that creates something. It gives you something to do.
And remember that we're using imagination. So if you're told loudmouth coward, then if you don't give me any more, if I'm the player, I'm like, that's all I think about. I don't have any more to let my imagination go. But if I say, again, loudmouth coward, who all the women hated and made fun of when he was younger as a child and was never good with women, then we go,
Wow, that sucks. I've been there. You know, like that kind of thing.
And you can all of a sudden expand your imagination goes more. That also you can create an image of that character in your mind, what he might look like, what he might be, what other things could have happened to him in his childhood. That's what you're trying to instill, trying to create, is more imagination.
And I think that if you have a lack of goal for the antagonist, then that is going to be a problem. For example, the 10 o'clock monster, a LARP game, where basically at 10 p.m., because everybody's bored, the GMs bring in a monster that comes in and he's like, "Rawr, I'm going to attack you." Okay, lame, first of all. The creatures have a reason to attack you. There should be a purpose. There should be something. If you're going to be bringing in an antagonist, it should have a goal. And without a goal, you're dealing with a set of numbers, and the players don't care. They're just there to beat the big chunk of whatever flesh that's in front of them.
And that's good for some people.
And I think that, I mean, I think we should make allowances for that. But personally, it's not what I want to do. I don't want to hammer on things that are, I don't want to hammer on a bunch of stats. If I do want to do that, again, I can get that out of a video game.
Yeah, and this is the thing. What we're saying is games like, say, D&D shouldn't just be about the wargaming. It should include the role-playing. And that's why fleshing out these antagonists are so important, to really add elements and add flavor and add interest.
Exactly. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have fights. I'm just saying we should have fights that matter. And I think that makes a far more fun game. Now, the last thing I want to talk about, really, is the players as antagonists. I think that is something that is an interesting thing, but it doesn't happen in a lot of games. I can only think off the top of my head of In a Wicked Age, where you literally have protagonist and an antagonist. They're all kind of tagonists. Everyone's playing people that have completely conflicting goals. And the idea behind that game is to push those conflicting goals as much as they can. And I think that's the only one I can think of off the top of my head, but I think even...
That's the best example, I think.
I think Hot War could do it too, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. I think many games can do it. But I think I like In a Wicked Age because it's clearly it's set up to be antagonists for each other. And you want to be creating elements that you want to pick at each other too. You want to be able to push against each other.
Conversations and discussion have to be established, but I think there's a certain really sense of sometimes playing the bad guy, especially if you're playing a bad guy that isn't just a terrible monster, is kind of fun. And it's interesting to explore that a little bit. I've played a character that has fallen from good to bad, and that was a lot of fun. In the Hot War game, my racist closet homosexual cop is a bad guy. He does terrible things. He plants evidence on innocent people because they're a different color or race or ethnicity than him.
Or he needs to prove he's right.
Yeah, in order to get this stuff done. And I think that he's an antagonist that's hoping having a redemptive arc. That's the intention that I want to do. I want to fix this broken man. And the player is moving towards that. We'll see if the dice favor it.
That's exactly what I think we were talking about, is antagonists go for both sides. Like, players and GMs are players. And so...
Exactly, you're
when
right.
When you're creating these antagonists, you're creating a character who... When you're players, you're creating characters. And so both sides are just creating characters who have opposing goals, who are then competing for the same things, and are fighting for each other, or fighting against each other for it.
The big thing is, you want to make them memorable, you want to make them interesting, and you want them to have the story that they richly deserve. And that story needs to mesh with the characters and fight with them and maybe win and maybe lose. I always like to make sure that that's not always... whether the characters win or not is not always the case. I like to keep that up in the air because I like a story that I don't know the ending of.
That's what role playing is.
The podcast. We kick boredom square in the nuts.
Movies, music, books, games, whatever's on our minds.
Now, due to the wonders of hotel internet, I have no idea what has been said for the last 30 seconds, but I'm sure it was interesting and full of, insight and, other good stuff.
Podcast.com.
Today we're going to be talking about couples and gaming. I'm John, and with me I have...
Kyle.
And?
Katie.
Kyle and Katie, could you tell me the nature of your relationship?
We're married.
There we go.
Easiest answer.
That's excellent.
I thought there was a deeper question there.
Just want to establish the baseline.
I was like, what is the nature of a relationship? That's a really deep question, John.
Tell me more. Look at this Rorschach test. Tell me. We're here to talk a little bit about gaming, and I wanted to, first of all, establish a little bit of history for the two of you so we can get a better idea of where the gaming lust came from. Probably not the best choice of words. Let's start with a bit of a history. What initially got you two into gaming? Because I'm looking at your enormous pile of games, and it seems that there is much love for gaming in all its forms, and where did it come from?
What John's referring to, first of all, to define gaming, is like all forms. We have a large stack of board games.
Yeah. And there's some card games in there. And
besides role-playing games.
Yeah.
You have 9 Burning Wheel books.
Some of them are yours, John.
That's true.
So they're not. In fact, I only own 3 Burning Wheel books. Some are Mike's, some are John's.
I read his book in bed.
I wasn't surprised by that.
So talk about it. Where did Chris come from?
I don't remember ever not playing games. I grew up in a family that played games together all the time.
So sorry, way back in the day?
Some story. There was a game I loved. I'm totally blanking on the name of it when I was a kid, but geekily enough, it was about spelling. You'd pick a word and you'd have the letters down in front of you, and other people would try and guess what the word was in front of you.
Oh, it's kind of like Guess Who, but for letters.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
I loved that one. My sister loved Smath, which was Scrabble, but mathy.
Right, right.
Dutch Blitz was huge with my surrogate family, my Dutch best friend. Blitz. It's a card game. It's a card game of speed.
I see. So you were both into card games and board games back in the day?
Yeah. My family, and then my best friend Greta and her family were all into board games and card games and all of that kind of stuff, and our families were really close, and so
right.
There'd be a great big schmozzle of families playing.
Playing the Dutch Blitz.
Yeah.
Did you ever play Bridge?
No, I've never played Bridge, Euchre and Canasta and Rook. My grandparents play Canasta and Rook as well, so I grew up with it going like generations higher as well.
Yeah, my grandmother used to always want to play Nickels with me, which I never really understood how to play. It was similar to Euchre, I think. I'm not really sure.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, anyways. But that's really interesting. I never had much. Most of my family would get together to argue, so that's really awesome. So Kyle, tell me a little bit about where your genesis came from.
My earliest memories are playing games. Both sides of the, particularly one side of the family, we had a cottage out like in Lake Country, and evenings would be, that's what you do in the evening, you pull a board game of some sort and you play that with the family. And we do, like, my mom, my father, my siblings, when they're old enough, my grandparents would all sit around and we'd play Romoli, Canasta.
We've never played Canasta together, and both of us grew up playing Canasta.
Yeah, I learned it, well, I mean, it was a little later on before I kind of picked that up. Rummy-O, which is a little bit different, it actually has chips, tiles, and this little board, and these chips you gotta put down and make, like, runs of things.
Oh, yeah!
We had a board, I never knew how to play it.
And Uno. Uh-huh. Oh my goodness, Uno. I remember my aunt suffering, but she sacrificed herself to my lust for Uno, as I demanded to play games, and because one of the things I was most interested in as a child was playing games. I found it really fun and enjoyable to do. And I guess I didn't have a huge variety of friends, so especially being in Lake Country all summer, I didn't have anybody in the area who I knew, so the people interaction I had with these adults, like my aunts, uncles, parents, all this stuff, and so games is a great way to interact with
it people. It does, it just crosses that divide between kids and adults.
Really. And I would win a lot.
Right on!
So...
did you win or did you win? Like, did they let you win?
No, they didn't let me win.
Really? That's right on.
No, no. My family never let me win because I was very competitive even as a young child.
I'm so surprised by that.
So my skill at competitive gaming is bred as a child, as a young child. I remember playing with my uncle, my father, a couple of people playing crib or cribbage.
Yeah.
Right.
And I remember winning and people going, and I was like, 8. And they're like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up with Crib 2 and backgammon.
Played backgammon.
We had our backgammon set folded up and had a little handle that looked like a briefcase.
Oh,
that's perfect.
And so every once in a while when I'd like play with it, when I was like playing, I don't know if I ever played house, but like playing house or whatever, I'd like pretend like I was a businesswoman in the backgammon case with my briefcase.
That's perfect.
Yeah, they put Monopoly money in there sometimes.
Oh, yes, you had successful businessmen.
Yeah, right on.
So, obviously, the two of you have a deep and abiding interest in games going from way back.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was the first game the two of you played together?
Settlers?
Probably Settlers.
Settlers of Catan, right on.
Yeah, because it was at game nights at 205 before we started dating.
Yeah. And
I remember Shadows of the Camelot.
Oh,
we played that one. I remember being really confused and intimidated because you guys were all into the whole role-playing aspect of that game, and I was like, I don't do this. I've been in drama. You guys are all just so bonded, and oh my god, what am I getting myself into?
You have to be... Shadows of Camelot, you're a knight, so you have to play
unless
the role.
Unless you're the traitor.
Unless you're the traitor, but even then
you're a knight. Even then you have to play the role, yeah. And it was just... It was crazy intimidating. Because Well, you're kind of in the group, but you know what these guys are like.
Oh,
like
yeah.
They've gamed together. This is Kyle and his roommates, and they've gamed together for so long that they all know what each other is gonna do, kind of ish, and they
not
all
really.
No, but you guys have this thing, and then here I am, a chick, which is weird in that group. It was predominantly men, and B, never having played this game, and C, not being someone who does role-playing games. I think I've gamed that kind of gaming, twice with you guys, and then once with my sister terribly awkwardly when I was 16.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, D&D.
We played some Mouse Guard a couple times.
Oh, yeah, so I've done Mouse Guard a couple times, too. But all of it except for that one awkward D&D with my sister when I was a kid, all of that has been since you and I have gotten together. So Shadows of Camelot was kind of intimidating.
A bridge game that kind of crumbled. So one of the things I was curious about was Kyle was mentioning his competitive streak. So when you're playing something like Settlers, which is a little bit of, there's a little bit of competition involved, especially if someone does some dick stuff with the roads. How does that go? Like again, the two of you are playing Settlers, and Kyle's utterly destroying you.
Well, let me explain. If I'm playing Settlers, let's say, with 3 or 4 people, the place gets crowded. And I tend to play very tactically. Like, I will hit people who I think are winning, without regard for, like, anybody else. Which
who they are.
Who they are. What they, and, but, like, if you're waiting, I will attack you. I will make sure that to target you. The problem with that is you make everybody your enemy, and then everybody attacks you back. And so I actually lose a bunch of those games because I make everybody my enemy.
He's a real jerk. I'm competitive, too, but I also will default to playing for the love of the game.
Right.
Like, I to change to one of the games that's my favorite is currently is Dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And I will play Dominion just because I love the game. Kyle plays to win. And so we've had to learn how to adapt to the way we each play that game because he'll play a short, quick game that's just done. And he's won. And I'm sitting there going, I bet, I'm totally unsatisfied.
You're like
completely unsatisfied.
I'm
like,
just I've got everything working.
I just got a whole bunch of fun cards and fuck, now I can't use them. And so sometimes I will play a quick and dirty game, and but more often he's nice enough to play for my love of the game.
And I enjoy the love of the game too, but I require that those games sometimes to satisfy my need.
You're like shark-like need to dominate and win.
There was a game we played with your mom that I purposely said it like, I said, this is the game, I'm going to be harsh, I'm going to win. And I won it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was going to be very straightforward, I had a plan, I had an idea, that I was going to go for it.
Yeah. My mom also loves Dominion and comes into the city once a month. Okay. And so we have a regular Dominion date with my mom.
But the thing is, even with the Dominion, unless I'm really going hardcore, I've lost games where I've tried to win, for sure.
I know, that's hilarious.
And I'm like, I love it. I think it's great, because I like it when I'm challenged.
Yeah.
If I'm losing, that's a good thing. That means I'm going to try harder. If I try harder, I'm still losing. I'm like, oh, this is great. Like, how am I going to win?
Yeah. Agricola is another one that we play together.
Yes,
and
yes.
Kyle's much more tactically minded than I am. Like, I've played Agricola I don't even know how many times, and I still at about round six start going, shit, it's about to get really hard, and I still don't have everything set up. And Kyle's like, producing enough food, feeding his people, he's already got 5 people, and it's like, I'm still playing the backpedaling game, and I don't know. So our brains work very differently, and that totally affects the way that we game, but we still play games together.
The interesting thing about Dominion is that you can pick cards where you're not necessarily playing against each other. Like, you're mostly playing a game, and it's really more of a timed event to see who gets to that point first.
Yeah.
Does that inform that sort of thing? Is that why it's enjoyable to play with Kyle, or more than just, straight out, killing each other, Risk?
So,
I refuse to play Risk.
Punch each other in the face, the game?
Risk is, I don't necessarily like Risk. It's fun with certain people, depending who you know, if you know who you're playing with.
It can be 6 hours.
Or it's half an hour. There's two ways. It's half an hour or 6 hours.
Everyone's just like, rah! And then it's like, if someone goes down to Australia and goes, I'm going to build, then it's 6 hours. Because again, you're talking about Agricola, which is, again, very much a playing beside each other. And even Settlers, to an extent, is like that, too. Because in terms of actual, kill each other games, you're not into Warhammer that much.
No, I'm a good Mennonite. I don't like conflict. Which I say like that, but it's also pretty true. I don't enjoy the games that are as much about destroying the other player. I like to play games where you play with another person. Like, Agricola and Settlers are similar, but Settlers, there's more interplay because you need to trade and do that kind of stuff. Although Agricola, there is the interactive deck, and that can make a good difference, too.
That's true.
Well, say, Dominion is, I've heard it referred to before, you're each playing your own game, and really then seeing who gets to that point first. I've heard that, but where Agricola, you actually have shared resources you have to, vie over. And so it makes a huge...
Starting player.
So Agricola is actually huge, it's huge between different people, who gets what, because every tile you choose, you can only choose it once for that round, and then the other person has denied that, now that choice.
Yeah. I play games very differently with Kyle than I do with other people, because I know he's going to be more tactical and he's going to be more aggressive, and so I will put that hat on as much as I do, but I will be a bit more aggressive. And with Kyle, I know if we're doing Agricola, I will go for starting player more often than I would playing with other people, because it's the only way I have a chance in hell.
And I also I guess there's been tacit permission being given for that. Like, it's like, okay, it's on. And it's okay, it's on.
Yeah.
Because like, I know that I've played with my brother is like the worst. I'm sorry, Dan. My brother is like the worst loser ever. Not so much anymore, but he used to be. He used to like flip over like I hate this game and I hate you.
Oh, he told me to go Calvin and Hobbes on it.
Yeah,
right?
He just used to flip out when he would land in like one of my Monopoly spaces or when he couldn't spell something with XKYU or whatever.
Aww,
in Scrabble. And so it's interesting that you can kind of put that hat on. You're like, okay, I can go into competitive mode and I know it's okay.
I'm still not overly competitive. Like, I know I don't really give Kyle a run for his money when we play games.
Depends on the game. It really does.
Yeah. And it depends on my mood, too. Like, often, if I've, you know, if it's been a work day, I come home and if we're going to play a game, I want to play a game just to be with Kyle. I don't want to play a game to play the game and win. You know, like, I just...
Take this, Kyle.
Yeah, I just... sometimes playing a game is just a vehicle to be together.
Yeah.
As opposed
absolutely.
To...
And it is absolutely true.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the things I like about Dominion, is because that one, it's easy to use it as a vehicle to just be together. Whereas something like Agricola, you need to be planning when it's not your turn, right? Dominion, yeah, you pick up your cards and you're like, oh, this is what I have this time. Okay, I'll put do it in this order. And then you can chat.
It's actually why I prefer multiple people at a game, is because there's more socializing allowed.
Yeah, I agree.
Where, like, sometimes there's just the two of us. I have a hard time detaching myself from the game to be socializing sometimes.
When we play Agricola, I admit, when it's his turn, because he takes so long to play his turn that I'm twiddling my thumbs, so I might as well be knitting.
And you have, it's mainly when we have the extra cards, when we play the advanced
version. Yeah, oh my gosh, yeah.
When it's the basic version, not so much.
Yeah.
With the advanced version, because there's so many options. Even you yourself, sometimes you turn quite long, because...
I know, but you're still epic.
Hands
down.
John,
you know,
I'm epic. I'm epic.
You take the more epic turns, hands down.
No, not epic turns, just epic.
just epic. That's it. That's all we heard. I'm just going to cut that part out for you, guys. For later on, you'll be like, Kyle, you're epic. Well, that's, you know, this has been really great. Thank you so much for this. Before I finish up, I want to... And it's already been touched on, I think, a couple of times by you anyways, but I want to ask the final question, which I think is a really neat one. What does gaming mean to you, and what does gaming mean to each other? But I think it's already been, it's been seeded all the way throughout this, but I want to encapsulate, summarize.
He's got a little grin on his face.
No,
I'm currently thinking,
I'm processing that question. There's huge satisfaction for me through that. And it's gaming, like, there's a tactical element, but it's expressed even stronger in role-playing itself. It's more than just tactical there. It's love of storytelling as well, and creation of stories. And even the tactical, it's the unknown. Like, I'm trying to compete, but I don't know if I will win or not. That's the whole point. I don't know what the result will be. And when I lose, that's enjoyable, because I couldn't have predicted that.
What about you, Katie?
I enjoy more the social aspect of gaming than the plotting to kill everybody else.
Dominate!
I do really like winning, don't get me wrong. I am competitive. In college, I played Dutch Blitz with a bunch of my friends, and I had one friend who was always a split second faster than me, and drove me up the wall.
Was he also scream sometimes? People would like...
Yeah, we got in trouble. Bible college, and then I'd be swearing.
Oh, yes.
And then there'd be people there for meetings from other churches, and they'd... Yeah, it was bad. I was the heathen child. but I like the social aspect of gaming. I miss game nights at 2:05. I really do. I miss the regular getting together, the excuse to hang out with these people. We're having friends over tonight to come over and play board games, actually.
Oh.
And it's a friend of mine that Kyle also likes, and her husband, and... Gaming is just a really great way for all of us to hang out. And it's a good way to get to know somebody that you don't know very well either.
It's an
like,
excellent
I don't think Kyle and I don't know what would have happened to us if there wouldn't have been game night. Right? I don't know. That's how we got to know each other, was game nights at 2:05.
Wow.
And then for, you kind of wanted to know what gaming meant for the two of us as a couple.
Yeah.
I enjoy the fact that because of Kyle, I play games that I wouldn't normally play. Right? Like, I've done more role-playing.
Mm-hmm.
And games like Cyclades, which is one that... we don't talk about that often. We don't play that often, but...
You need more than two people, though.
Yeah, you do. But, you know, games like Sick Leaves and Talisman and Shadows Over Camelot, those are probably all games that I wouldn't have found out about if I wouldn't have met you.
Yeah.
And you challenged me to play games in a different way as well.
It was
I know, your my cousin. Relative who gave you Cyclades. So I would have heard about Cyclades. Okay, so but like he might not have looked up that game if it wouldn't have been for you and your love of Greek and Roman history and mythology. Right. So
and to encapsulate I think all of that, it's a default. Like, if we don't know what else we're going to do, we just play a game and we can enjoy each other's company that way.
True.
Like, it's a beast watching TV, for sure. Unless it's a castle.
Oh, castle. Or Buffy.
Oh, Nathan Fillion.
All right, guys. Oh, Nathan
Fillion. You love him too. All
right, well, thank you very much. This was excellent.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, that's it.
Music from You Can Hack It is by Buck65. You can get it free from his website.